Break. As we return, we will unravel more strategies on how to face the challenges posed by AI when it comes to child upbringing. So stay tuned.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're here to take a deep dive into the topic of AI when it comes to child upbringing. Professor, you said that one has to take care of ethics, morals, while using technology, and parents can help their children because before AI, social media was a big threat. It still is. However, now as AI bots are at the service, or the entire AI is at their service, and that too, we have many free AIs. So this in itself poses a threat to our children. This is even beneficial for our children. And now you're saying that parents have to take care of some of the ethics, some of the morals they should be teaching to their children when they deal with these kind of tech.
I mean, the real threat that we face today is that will artificial intelligence and machines become autonomous? That is the threat that mankind faces. I mean, we have this doomsday scenario, which is even, I mean, you can see, you can observe it in the various fiction movies where Skynet is taking over the world.
Yeah.
Maybe. So, but because of that, there could be a remote possibility that such a thing could happen. It has to be taken into account. It cannot be completely, removed from our minds that such a threat exists.
Well, but we know that the Ahsanul Khaliqeen is the Allah Subhanahu Wa Taala, and He is the one who is the best of the creators. But yet, these threats do exist. But what are the threats that parents have to take care of when it comes to upbringing?
That threat cannot be, as I said, kept out of mind. But the important thing is today we're not there. We're still here where we have machines which can help us and they can augment us and our development and our children's education and their learning and in their professional lives.
Right.
They can learn to use AI as a tool for their benefit.
Right.
So this is what we need to, teach our children and make them aware that use AI and machine learning for your own benefit, for the
right.
benefit of other human beings. And still, we are still there. The only problem is that when we come to the to protect ourselves and our future generations from that doomsday scenario where possibly a person, a human being, will be the cause of such a doomsday scenario.
Right.
A human being, a wicked person, could do that, maybe.
Right.
That he sets up some sort of technology which creates a situation where he controls the world through these robots. To prevent that from happening, we need to educate our children. We need to make them good human beings so that such a human being does not come into existence. And if he is there out there, we
how
need
to face him.
How to face him and fight him off. Unfortunately, one of the things which is being, as a threat to us as Muslims, as Shia Muslims, as followers of the Imam Mahdi, as those who are waiting for Imam Mahdi to come, there's again a doomsday scenario maybe. They want to say that Imam Mahdi will be created out of artificial intelligence maybe.
Right. So that's a point to expand more upon, and we'll do that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات
Imam Ali alayhi salam said, be like a friendly physician. who applies medicine where it is useful.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We have Professor Sayyid Salman Nakhawi with us. And Professor is telling us about the ethics that parents should be working upon with their children when it comes to AI. Professor, you said that there are many challenges that AI brings with itself. And parents have got a lot to do when it comes to upbringing of their children and dealing with this AI. Now, you said that one of the biggest threats that we face today is that maybe AI tomorrow comes and says that Imam would be generated by the AI itself. So there, how do we tell our children who are waiting there to be the soldiers of Imam, how do our children and both parents deal with this situation?
So we need our children to understand what on the characteristics of Imam Mahdi, how we should recognize Imam Mahdi, Jalla Ta'ala Faraj Sharif, how we need to work for his advent, how we want him to be back in our midst so that we become his competent followers and companions.
Right.
We need to inculcate in our children the love of Allah and Imam Mahdi as the awaited Imam. And then we need to be able to make them realize the difference between maybe imposters and the true Imam. So this awareness has to be created. And so tomorrow, yes, certainly, with the advent of Imam Mahdi, ajallahu ta'ala hushif, technological advancement may have reached to very high degrees.
Right.
And then humanity will be facing this challenge that how Imam Mahdi is going to tackle these issues and how he needs our support and assistance to do that. So we need to be aware, our children need to be taught about Imam Mahdi, what he wants us to do, what he is going to do when he comes, what he expects us to do. So maybe the time is quite close. It may be even very close to us, very near in the future.
Right.
So are we prepared for that? And there's no doubt about the fact that when Imam Mahdi comes, technological advancement. Today, even the advancement that we see out in the world today in the form of something which is, for example, the technology which is there out in the market.
Right.
It's something which has been developed maybe decades ago, and it has been used in military projects.
Right.
And in things associated with the military.
Right.
Or sensitive issues like that. And then gradually it becomes something open.
True.
So today, as far as material, as far as the use of technology in warfare goes, it has become much advanced.
Right.
Today, even today, a person sitting thousands of miles away can sit there and control an armed drone and, kill the enemy, for example.
Right.
And destroy a village. We see so many drone attacks by the American forces sitting thousands of kilometers away in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, using drones which are complete robots.
Right.
So there's so much destruction in this type of technology.
And here parents have
and
got
we
a
should
big
know
role.
That tomorrow, if we are going to become competent scholars of Imam Mahdi, supporters and companions of Imam Mahdi, we must be aware of these things.
Right. So you're saying that parents, knowing these destructive things that the enemies can create, that the arrogant world is creating, need to actually educate their children about all these and also make them prepared so that they become the real soldiers of Imam Mahdi. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor, and giving us those beautiful tips. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Thank you. largest refugee camp in the world. Rakhine State in Myanmar, or Burma, is home to a cultural, religious, and linguistic ethnic group called the Rohingya, which is described by the United Nations as one of the most persecuted minorities in the world. For decades, the Rohingya people have been marginalized and persecuted by the Buddhist government of Myanmar. The government does not recognize the Rohingya as one of its 135 official ethnic groups. Following the 1982 citizenship law passed by the Myanmar military junta, the Rohingya stripped of their citizenship. The law denied the Rohingyas the right to education or any kind of health care. They didn't have the right to work, get married, or own lands. The government forced the Rohingyas to live in ghetto-like refugee camps with limited access to food and health care services. 1 million Rohingyas are now stateless. They belong to no country in the world.
There are many difficulties with access of education for the children after the fifth grade because there's nothing outside, inside the camp. There's issues about having access to health other than the most basic health services. There are issues of freedom of movement. And then there is the fundamental issue of the status of these people. These people deserve a better future than the present condition of extreme poverty, deprivation, and isolation.
The Naaf River is a natural border separating Bangladesh from Myanmar and is located in the western state of Rakhine, also known as Arakan. The Rohingyas were left with no choice but to escape persecution through this body of water to take refuge in Bangladesh, a country where Muslims make up almost 90% of the total population. In August 2017, following an attack by a Rohingya insurgent group, the Burmese army launched a savage military campaign against hundreds of villages inhabited by the Muslim minority. According to statistics provided by Doctors Without Borders, MSF, the Burmese army burned down 288 villages in Rakhine State, killing at least 6,700 innocent Muslims. As a result, over 900,000 people fled Myanmar to neighboring countries to escape what the United Nations described as a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. The United Nations declared in a report that it has no doubt about the existence of hate speech in Myanmar and confirmed its role in escalating tensions. The UN said hateful rhetoric had provoked the Rohingya to embrace incitements and calls for violence. The report also highlights the role of social media platforms, such as Facebook, in further spreading hatred. It is estimated that there are 20 million Facebook users out of the 53 million strong population of Myanmar. The British occupation. The emergence of the spirit of nationalism among the Burmese. Japanese invasion. The Japanese expel the British and the Buddhists from Arakan by attacking British allies and Muslims, including the Rohingyas. The formation of the military junta government. The military regime of General Ne Win recognizes the Rohingya as illegal immigrants and starts attacking them. Citizen law is passed, which brands the Rohingya as illegal immigrants. More than 250,000 Rohingyas flee from persecution. In October 1991, Aung San Suu Kyi is awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Thailand expels about 100 Rohingyas back into the open sea with little water and food. The conflicts between Muslim Sikhs and the Buddhist army forces 30,000 Rohingyas to leave their homes. Leader of Myanmar's anti-Muslim movement, Mongkut Wirathu, is accused of instigating violence. The National League for Democracy, with Aung San Suu Kyi as its president, wins the election and the Nobel Peace Prize laureate, becomes the state councillor of Myanmar and spokesperson of the government. August 25, 2017. The Burmese government orchestrates a campaign against supposed terrorist forces who cause death and displacement of some 900,000 Rohingya Muslims. The UN accuses the military of Myanmar of committing crimes against humanity, genocide and war crimes against the Rohingya Muslims. The UN calls for the prosecution of six Burmese generals at the International Criminal Court. The organization also accuses Aung San Suu Kyi of not taking enough measures to prevent the violence. The government of Myanmar dismisses the report. The Rohingya have suffered from systematic discrimination since the end of the British occupation. Members of this cultural, religious, and linguistic ethnic group are the descendants of Muslims who came from an area known today as Bangladesh and Western Bengal. The community had lived almost without problems until Myanmar became part of British colonial India in 1824. For over a century and up until 1930, millions of Asians, both Muslims and Hindus, came to the country to work as civil servants and day laborers. As a result, deep resentment toward these communities started to grow in the most impoverished Burmese population. In 1982, the military regime of General Ne Win passed a law which stipulated that only descendants of the ethnic groups who had settled in the territory of Myanmar before the British occupation were recognized as full citizens. Those who didn't fit into that category were left stateless. They had no nationality. Therefore, they did not have the right to own land. This made them subject to extortion and forced labor under the command of the military battalions deployed in the area. Almost 1 million people live in Cox's Bazar, a town in Bangladesh bordering Myanmar. The area has become the largest refugee camp in the world. The official refugee camps are called Kutupalong and Balukali, but unofficial makeshift camps have also been erected around them. The refugees still don't have access to basic needs such as drinking water, sanitation, and hygiene facilities. This seriously affects their physical and mental health. Overcrowded camps, long distances, and concerns about safety often prevent women, especially pregnant women and little girls, from using these services. More than half of the Rohingya refugees are children. In 2018, almost 48,000 babies were born in congested refugee camps in Bangladesh. The government did not grant them Bangladeshi citizenship. Many refugee children suffer from a weakened immune system. Most of them arrive without getting vaccinated, and that makes them more vulnerable to diseases. After registering thousands of cases of diphtheria and measles when they arrived last year at the camps, Doctors Without Borders carried out a vaccination campaign against cholera, diphtheria and measles. The torrential rain season in Bangladesh, called the monsoon, could damage the weak structure of the refugees' shelters. The landslides are destroying the camps and taking their lives. The undulating terrain, covered with small hills, makes it difficult to build new shelters or access the existing ones, particularly for the elderly and the disabled. There is also a high risk of catching diseases through touching or consuming contaminated water. Since movement is highly restricted in the congested makeshift settlements, a cholera outbreak is quickly spreading among the refugees of the camp, which can be likened to a gigantic quagmire. A year after the crackdown in Myanmar, the refugee camps in Bangladesh are still overcrowded, and the Rohingya live in conditions below the minimum humanitarian standard. The majority of the Rohingya are living in a legal limbo in Bangladesh. They are neither citizens of Myanmar, nor do they have refugee status, and this prevents them from accessing basic services and restricts their freedom to move outside the camps. Regional host states, such as Bangladesh or Malaysia, deny the Rohingya formal legal status. Although they are stateless, they are not recognized as qualified refugees. In November 2018, the United Nations, Myanmar and Bangladesh signed an agreement to launch a repatriation program, which allows the Rohingyas to return to their homes in Rakhine. After interviewing 875 victims of Myanmar's gruesome violence, the UN's Independent International Fact-Finding Mission on Myanmar released a report accusing the Myanmar military of committing a genocide, the most serious accusation ever made against a government in the international law. More than 130 Asian parliamentarians sought to bring the case to the International Criminal Court. The authorities in Myanmar, including the Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, have refuted almost all the charges and refused to cooperate with international investigators and human rights organizations. On the other hand, as long as security and a lasting peace are not guaranteed in Rakhine, the Rohingyas cannot safely return to their homes. According to the UN and its experts, the forced displacement, a hasty repatriation, has awakened a long-standing fear among these people, since they have experienced similar incidents of violence in the 70s, 80s and 90s, and despite all the lives lost, an integration program was never adopted, and the Rohingya witnessed nothing but more segregation and stricter military control.
Start.
Movement.
Speak.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In your name, we shall start all the stories. Yes, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers from every nook and cranny of this huge world. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. Well, I'm Asma, and here with me...
Assalamu alaikum, my name is Abu Zahra. Happy to be here.
Yeah. Well, we're again in the Youth Station, and I'm sure we're going to have an amazing session again. Because Youth Station is always amazing. Nowadays, wherever you look, even in the libraries, the most of the titles that you could see are just about success. How to achieve success, how to attain success, the laws of success, whatever about success. But are there any laws for success? Now, that's a question I usually ask myself whenever I do not achieve whatever I want. I say, okay, were there any laws that if you pursued, you would have got the best of whatever you had in your mind? Or no, it is a random thing that happens. Well, the answer is obviously success is not a haphazardly happened sort of a thing. It comes by a plan and by a clear sketch in your mind. You must have a clear plan in your mind and then try for it accordingly. And then you could achieve the sort of success that you have in your mind. Still, there are many people who prescribe their own method for every single individual outside. But I think this one is not true because it differs from one person to another. Maybe your strategy is not going to work on me. Or vice versa.
Yeah. So the thing is, when it comes to success, firstly, success has so many definitions. Like, what do you count as success? What you think of success might be different to what I think as success.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you come and say these are the, you know, the keys or the laws, the rules of success in life, well, you're sort of forcing your definition of success on me and then pushing me into the path that led you to success, right?
Yeah.
So you're enforcing two things on me. One is the definition of success, and two, you're assuming that the way you reach success, I'm also going to reach success
in that
way. So
the definition of it obviously differs from one person to another.
Technically, human being success is one, right? We live in this life for one purpose, and all of us live for that one purpose. How we get to that purpose and how we navigate in this life to reach that ultimate purpose is going to be different for everybody. But the ultimate purpose of the human being is one and the same, right? Yes, success in different aspects. So success in my career, success in my relationships.
Spirituality.
Success in my spirituality, success in
my physical body.
You know, there's success in different things. And
each one has got a definition for itself.
So I think that somebody might say being successful means being happy, right? And if that's what they see it as, then, for example, you don't need to be a billionaire to be super rich. A lot of people who write these success books are millionaire and billionaires, right? And they assume that they're going to take you through this career path or this you know, entrepreneurship path, whatever it is, to reach those billions so that you can be happy. And I'm like, one second, happiness is not tied with money necessarily.
So according to my definition.
Yeah. So I can be happy without having to go through this. So thanks for wasting my time.
But generally speaking, I suppose, as human beings, they would define success as achieving whatever you want in whatever field you just said.
In whatever things you come across in life, right?
Yeah.
So in your family. So the main things human beings have in life are your relationships and your career, right?
Yeah.
And, well, we're Muslims, our spirituality, right?
Exactly.
And our spirituality is the most important one, right? So these are basically the three main areas you look for success in, right? Your education, again, tied with your career. I don't know, your physical. Okay,
they've
then there's
got
your
some
physical body as well.
Of course.
Yeah. But I think a lot of them fall into these three or four categories, right? But I think that because the human being's ultimate purpose is one, I think we should define success as reaching that purpose. The success of our relationships is defined by the success, how it's taking us to our ultimate goal. The success in our, let's say, our careers is defined or should be defined by how it's helping us succeed in our ultimate goal.
Yeah, so
and if we look at it like this, then I would say everybody's success in general is more or less the same. Okay, the parts may be different. How we apply the laws are different, but there are laws. There should be laws.
So if I'm an engineer who does not get too much of money from people for just creating their houses or whatever, still I'm a successful person.
If I'm following the things that will take me to my ultimate purpose.
Which is salvation. See, I'm doing this for the satisfaction of Allah.
For example.
Intention of His satisfaction in my
mind. Exactly. So if I'm an engineer and I'm working sincerely, I'm working honestly, I'm putting a lot of effort, and still despite all of that, okay, I'm not getting so many opportunities, and let's say, you know, I'm doing my best. I'm not neglecting anything.
Yeah.
But the life circumstances are such that I'm not getting too many contracts and stuff like that.
That if you compare that engineer to another engineer who does everything for money and has achieved too much of houses, cars, whatever,
and
luxurious
he's got a lot
life.
Of money.
If you compare them to maybe in a mundane, worldly perspective, you could say that the other one is more successful.
Exactly.
But the truth is, in God's eyes, the other engineer who's been doing things for the intention of satisfaction of Allah is the most successful.
He's truly successful. The other one seems to be successful.
Not just those people who have money are successful. There are many people who do not have much of money, but they are successful because they are looking for a greater purpose.
A greater purpose and the true purpose of our life.
Yeah. So let's go for a break and then we'll be back with some more.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Yes, well, this is Youth Station. We're talking about success, the laws of success. The most important thing in success, I suppose, is to be very much steadfast and hardworking and have too much of motivation and try to create that motivation for yourself. You see, we had this entrance exam the previous year. And then the problem is for those students who are not in touch with a school or any academic environment, it's very difficult to keep up with the motivation and the driving force. Because some mornings when you wake up, you just feel like, okay, why am I going through all these? This is all nonsense. Life is moving, and I'm the only one who is just doing nothing in their life, reading the same books all the time, and things like this. But the thing is, if you want to success, you have to be your own driving force, and you have to create that motivation in yourself.
There's something really interesting. I've been seeing social media recently, and I think this is something that's been lacking a lot in the current modern culture, and I think they've realized it's lacking, so they're trying to bring it back. And that's the idea of discipline and perseverance. You see a lot of social media people, a lot of motivational speakers and influencers that talk about discipline, that you don't do things just because they feel good. You do things because that's what you need to do, right? And you have to discipline yourself. So if you want to reach success, you can't reach success by just following your desires and what you feel like every morning you wake up and, oh, I feel like doing this.
You won't reach
anywhere, right? You need to discipline yourself. You need to do things even if you don't want to do them. And that's very hard.
Yeah.
That's why it's called discipline. That's why it's called perseverance. Mm-hmm. In Islam, we call it istiqamah, right? There is no progress without istiqamah, right? You have to persevere. You have to keep going even when it's hard, even when it's boring, even when it's dull.
When it's very difficult.
Yeah, even when it's very difficult, you have to just keep pushing yourself.
Exactly.
And things will distract you. Life is about that. You'll get distractions, you'll get different troubles and tribulations and, you know, things happening in life, but you have to keep persevering and keep moving forward.
And the funny part is that just as soon as you try to make a plan in your mind towards something, towards success and your own goal, everything all of a sudden happened to you. And then you have to moderate everything.
You have to
just handle them all together. So you should have it in mind that things do not happen easily.
And they don't happen the way you plan it. That's why you mentioned a few times that you need to plan things out in your mind. But I feel a lot of things are not in your hands that you can't plan for.
Yeah.
You need to plan for the big things. You need to have some idea of where you're going.
Yeah.
You can't really step by step decide for yourself exactly how it's going to go. Because it's not in your hands, right? The time is not in your hands.
Yeah, that's
how
the
it's
going to
happen is
exactly.
not in your hands. You have to have a reasonable amount of planning. So I'm not suggesting don't plan. No, you need to plan and you need to have a reasonable amount of planning.
But just to write the headlines, I guess,
exactly.
because the other things are going to change. Nothing is in your hands.
Exactly, Because I feel some people plan too far ahead. They're like, okay, right now, okay, I'm 18, so I'm going to finish school in 1 year and then I'll go to university and then I'll do this degree and then I'll...
And they forget and then, about the providence.
Yeah, and then I'll get a job in this area, so I'll get a house in this area, then I'll get a car, then I'll get married, then I'll have... By this age, I'll have 2 kids and... Whoa, like, where do you get this from, right? How are you assuming you're going to get this job and things might go completely different, right?
Exactly.
So we need to have a general idea of what we want to do and follow those principles of success, right?
Yeah.
Of success in the real sense, right?
And
not just
to
money
stick
success.
To them, even if they are simple, tiny tasks that you do every day.
Yeah.
So right now, let's go for a break and then we'll be back with the last part of today's episode. Yes, success is the fruit of your hardship and of your efforts that you do in silence without anybody noticing that. Most of the time, the thing that happens is that all the people who get to attain the sort of success they have in their mind were silent for too long. Actually, you didn't see them. And after some years...
And all of a sudden, just pop up.
Yeah, all of a sudden, you see this totally different person coming in front of your eyes. And that's just because of the discipline, I suppose, you mentioned.
Yeah, it's discipline. It's like, put your head down and do what you need to do.
Yeah.
Stop bragging around. Stop, making big claims for yourself. Just focus on what you need to do, right? Don't be distracted,
If you have the motivation and if you put too much of effort and hard work, then Allah Himself is going to reward you with the success that you have in your mind. And another important thing is that, okay, you have a sketch and plan in your mind. You work so hard. You try to be your own motivation. But then there's another thing that you have to keep in mind, that you should leave everything to Allah. the outcome, of course. You try, but you leave the outcome for Allah, and you are sure that whatever that happened to you is the best of the things that could have happened to you, yeah. because He's the one who knows all your ups and downs, and He knows what is best for you.
Yeah.
So because, you know, there are many people who try so much, but they did not get what they wished for.
Yeah.
And it has got so much of justifications, spiritually speaking.
Spiritually, even physically, we don't know that if we had got this step, this next step, if we had got it, then
what would have happened to me?
Right? Yeah. It might have been something bad for us. That's why the Quran gives us, well, this is one of the keys to success, right? The Quran tells us that, look, you may like something, but it's bad for you.
Exactly.
And you may dislike something, but it's good for you.
Yeah.
Right? And this is a reality of life. And so Allah tells us that, look, you act on what you're supposed to do. You do your best
in
where you are right now. And the outcome, like you said, the outcome is in Allah's hands. Don't fool yourself in thinking that just because you decided you want this outcome, then it has to be good for you.
Yeah.
That outcome should be bad for you. So let Allah decide for you. And He will take you through life, right? He will help you. You again have your reasonable plan that makes sense. You do your best and you'll see Allah, you know, driving you through life and making things happen. And things might not look positive necessarily straight away.
Yeah.
But in the long run, when you look back, you'll be like, wow, this was amazing how Allah,
maybe after 10 years you would understand.
It could be after 10 years, it could be after much less, you know. You don't know what Allah has planned for you. You don't know what's the best for you.
Exactly.
Allah knows that. And in each situation you're in, basically, it's like Allah is saying, I want to see how you're managing this. If you manage it properly, the outcome will definitely be good for
you. Exactly.
I just want to see how you manage it. Right?
He says it, he say it, you try and I will give you the blessings.
You try and I'll give you, exactly. Yeah,
yeah, their words come with Allah. So
yeah. One of the things that's really important in that part of success is that it takes time, right?
Yeah.
It takes time and effort. And this is why I think that, you know, especially those who are young, they should make the most of their time. You know, you're young, you're energetic, you have a lot of free time. Right, this is the time to use that free
because
time.
Because that's the spring of your lifetime.
Yeah, because later on in life, you'll be bogged down with your careers, with your family, if you know, your wife, your children, your husband, your children, you know, and different difficulties that come with age, physical difficulties, you know, mental things.
So much of things would get into your way.
So many things come in our way. So the youth time, and that's unfortunately the time that most people waste in playing
are
games.
Are just blind and headless.
Yeah, they're just wasting time. Sometimes not even, you know, they don't even play games, just lying in bed doing nothing.
Yeah.
Right?
Idle.
Just scrolling through social media, being idle, doing it's like, you know, you're wasting such a potential.
Exactly.
You want to succeed in life, but you're not doing anything about it. Do it right now because this is when you have the energy.
So
this
your
when
youth
you have the time.
Is a precious pearl. Do not just take it for granted.
It's really, really precious. And the opportunities you get when you're young, they never come back when you're old.
Exactly.
Right? So
that's
you make
very
the most
true.
Of it right now and you put all the effort right now and you'll see the fruits much sooner.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start working on it later, then you never know if you're going to get to the end of it or not.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Now is the time to work
on it. So try to make the best out of your youth because it's not going to ever come back. So thank you for staying with us. I hope you so much of success for whatever you have in your mind. And I wish Allah to be on your side forever. Thank you for being with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio. For those who seek the truth.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
answering it down some questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atan, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker to answer my questions for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We know that on the day of Ashura in the year 61 AH, Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was beheaded. You know, he and so many of his companions were beheaded, and the heads were on the spears taken to different cities up until the main palace of the Yazid. Now, we know that the body was buried by Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam in the same land of Karbala over there. But since the head was taken away from the body and it was in different cities as a sign of, for example, warning or threatening the people and the other enemies of Yazid. Now, the question is that was the head back to the body and buried same place, or it was buried in some other places?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yes, as you rightly mentioned, there is no doubt about the fact that, first of all, the holy body of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was buried without his holy head, as it was taken by the soldiers of Umar ibn Sa'd to the Kufa and then to the city of Sham. And this is one of the ways through which the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam were persecuted, seeing the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam on their spears. Now, when it comes to what happened to the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we have different viewpoints, and that is why we have Maqam Ra's al-Hussein nowadays in some places in the world, in different cities. Now, according to one of them, it is buried in the same place as the body, but according to other viewpoints, the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was buried in a different place.
Yes.
So it was not joined to the body. The first idea is that the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was buried in the city of Medina. Ibn al-Mahili, one of the Shiite scholars, he says that some people have claimed that Amr ibn Sa'id buried the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in Medina. And some people have claimed that the head was buried in Jannatul Baqi in the city of Medina. And of course, some have claimed that it was buried next to the grave of Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, which is of course unknown.
Okay.
This is one viewpoint. The second viewpoint is that it was buried in Damascus. So the final place where the caravan were taken was Damascus and the palace of Yazid. And according to one historical report, the holy head was buried by a slave near the gate of Faradis in Damascus.
Yes.
The third viewpoint is that it was buried in the holy city of Najaf, next to the grave of Imam Ali alayhi salam. There is a narration by Umar ibn Talha. He says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam took us to a place, and finally we went toward the city of Najaf, and there Imam Sadiq alayhi salam told one of his companions that send salam to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. That companion, whose name was Ismail, he told Imam that Imam Hussein alayhi salam is buried in Karbala. But Imam says that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, according to this narration, he says that when his holy head was taken to Sham or Syria, one of our friends, one of the Shia, took it and buried next to the grave of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Najaf. I don't want to say that this is an authentic narration. I'm just referring to different viewpoints.
Yes.
The same has been mentioned by Abu Nabil Taghlib. According to him also, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in Najaf referred to a place which is the place where the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was buried.
Ra's al-Hussein fin Najaf.
Exactly.
Yes.
And we have it a number of other narrations in this regard, but I mean the majority of the Shia scholars do not believe in the authenticity of these narrations.
But you still, when you go to the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam, Ra's al-Hussein is known, isn't it? In the holy city of Najaf. Around the holy shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam, there is a special place called where the head stayed over there for some times. That's right?
Yeah, that's
but
a
it is not buried.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, that's a possibility as well. The next viewpoint is in Egypt, in Cairo.
Oh.
And nowadays, it seems that there is a place, Ra's al-Hussein, famous among the people.
Far land. Yeah. How is it possible?
Septim al-Jawzi, he says that when Imam Hussein alayhi salam's caravan were taken to Damascus, then the head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was taken from Damascus to Asqalan in Egypt, and then it was taken to Cairo, and it was buried there. And nowadays there is a holy shrine for it, and people come to visit it. And Allama Sayyid Muhsin Amin in Lawa'ijul Ashjan, he also says that the Alawis of Egypt, they took the head from Asqalan to Cairo, and they buried in Cairo, and they built a great and a splendid building over it. And of course, Sayyid Muhsin Amin raises the question whether in reality it was the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam as well.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
Praises to Allah, all glory is to Allah, we worship Allah and no one but Allah.
And this is another viewpoint that the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, according to some people, was taken from Damascus to Asqalan and then to Cairo, and it was buried there. But there are some doubts about the authenticity of these reports.
Yes.
And, of course, as I mentioned, nowadays there is a place in Cairo, Masjid al-Mashhad al-Hussein.
Yes.
And there is a building there. People go to visit, and many people believe that this is the place where the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam has been buried. And even miracles have been witnessed by the people in that place.
Okay. Which one is the most authentic one?
I will come to the most authentic one. That is the next one.
Mm-hmm.
Some people claim that because miracles have been happened there in Maqam Mashhad Ra's al-Hussein in Egypt, so this is the place. But this is not true. I mean, highly possible that it's not the real place, but because of the fact that people pay attention to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and they mourn for Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam in that very place, so Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is showing miracles as well. For example, some people are healed there. So there is no relation between, I mean, seeing and witnessing miracles and that this is the place where the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam is buried. The most authentic and the most famous viewpoint is that the holy head of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam was returned back to Karbala and it was joined to his holy body.
Body, that's right.
This is the most authentic one, and the viewpoint that the great and the majority of the Shia scholars, they believe in.
So you mean the body was buried? Then it was what? Then it was, for example, the head was attached to the body again?
Yeah.
Okay.
According to this understanding, okay. Let me share what Sayyidina Tawus says in this regard. He says that the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was taken back to Karbala and it was buried and was joined to his holy body. Also, Sheikh Tabrizi in Taj al-Mawali says that the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, according to some great Shia scholars, was taken back from Syria and it was attached to the holy body of Imam Hussein alayhi salam in Karbala. The same had been mentioned by other Shia scholars like Ibn Fattal Nishaburi in Rawdatul Wa'izin, Ibn Namahili in Muthirul Ahzan, and according to Abu Rehan Biruni, one of the great Muslim scholars, the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was attached to his holy body on the 20th of the month of Safar, the day of Arba'een.
Mm-hmm.
In his book, he says that Ufil Ashreen wrote the Ra's al-Hussein ila majthameh hatta dufana mahajuthateh wa fihi ziyarat al-Arba'een. On the day of Arba'een, the 20th of the month of Safar, the holy head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was taken to Karbala and it was joined to his holy body. That's among right. The Sunni scholars, we can refer to Ibn al-Jawzi, who passed away in 654. He also says in Tathkiratul Khawas that the most famous idea is that the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was taken from Medina to Karbala, according to him, and it was buried, it was joined to his body. Also, Zakir ibn Muhammad Qazwini in Ajab al-Makhluqat, he says that Al-Yam al-Awwal min Eid Bani Umayyah. The first day of the month of Safar is feast for Bani Umayyah. Udkhilat fihi Ra's al-Husayn radiyallahu anhu bi Dimashq. On this day, on the first day of the month of Safar, the head of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam was, it was brought to Damascus. Wal-Ishroon min ruddat Ra's al-Husayn ila juthatih. And on the 20th day of the month of Safar, the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was taken back to Karbala to be attached to his body. So these are, different viewpoints. As I mentioned, the most authentic and the most famous one among the Shia scholars is that the head was joined to the body, and nowadays, it was buried in the land.
And some might ask, what is the significance of this question? Because Imam al-Hussein was the only imam that was beheaded, so that's why Ra's al-Hussein, for the Shiite and for the Shiite community, is very much important. But if the body, if the head was back to the grave, it must be buried by a holy imam, necessarily Imam al-Sajjad alayhi salam, isn't it?
What we have in the narrations, it is about the body of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, which was buried by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. But as for head, there is no indication telling that it was done by Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. It is a possibility, but it seems that there is no authentic historical report in this regard.
That's all right. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh, for a nice elaboration regarding Ra's al-Hussein. Of course, there have been so many miracles also mentioned by Ra's al-Hussein on the way to Shamat. Let's discuss them in our upcoming session of the program.
Sure.
And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li حسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم
كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن إن في الجنة نارا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
Eye on Islam.
Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you, and welcome to another edition of Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Each week we'll look at a story which has a direct relevance to the beautiful religion of Islam, and we break it down from a Muslim perspective. Recently, the Muslim world marked World Mosque Day, a day which is dedicated to the importance of the Islamic place of worship and a timely reminder of why going to and protecting your local masjid is an important obligation. However, the incident which inspired the founding of this day is based on a horrific attack targeting one of the greatest sites in the Muslim world, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Palestinian capital, Jerusalem Al-Quds.
The anniversary of the burning of the Al-Aqsa Mosque on August 21, 1969, has been named as World Mosque Day. The attack was perpetrated by an extremist Christian settler who traveled all the way from Australia to burn the third holiest site in Islam. Despite the settler admitting his crimes, Israel denied it, claiming an electrical malfunction caused the fire. As the fire burned, Palestinians managed to extinguish the flames using buckets and simple tools. Their success came despite being denied access to the mosque by the Israeli regime forces, who additionally cut off water sources. In response to this vile act, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation declared the 21st of August as World Mosque Day, after a proposal by Iran was agreed and accepted. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, emphasized the importance of World Mosque Day, saying, "The World Mosque Day is basically a revolutionary day." The recognition of this day was addressed in a bid to reevaluate the importance and position of mosques, especially the Al-Aqsa Mosque, to the Muslim Ummah. Other examples of the vital role masjids play could be seen during Iran's 1979 revolution, when mosques assisted in the spreading of information, supporting oppressed peoples, and offering a location to organize communities amid a brutal crackdown by the state. Mosques have also been used as a way to serve communities all over the world, including during the COVID pandemic, which saw mosques across the world engaging in initiatives to help people who struggle to find food, leave their homes, or lacked family support when ill. Food giving, charity, advice, and other services are all offered by mosques, which aid millions of people every year. As well as offering Muslims a means of praying together as a community, and helping to spread Dawah across the non-Muslim world. 53 years later, Al-Aqsa is still under Israeli threats and attack. Israel wants to obliterate the Islamic identity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque, with some fearing it'll be removed and replaced with a new temple. No matter what crimes Israel and other extremist settlers commit, Palestinians continue to struggle to protect their beloved mosque.
Well, joining us today to talk about Al-Aqsa and mosques in general is our esteemed guest, Sayed Mohsen Abbas, who is a TV producer, broadcaster, presenter and journalist based here in Britain, and I must say a friend of the channel. Welcome once again, Sayed. It's a pleasure to have you back on the show. Now, obviously a lot of our audience might not remember what happened specifically on that saddening day when Al-Aqsa Mosque was attacked in a very horrific way. Not the first time it's been targeted, but that was one of the most notable horrific incidents which could have seen the site possibly even lost for good. That's what many people would have feared at the time. Just tell us about this shocking attack. It was conducted by a Zionist Christian from Australia.
Yeah, I think the most significant thing about the attack is the complicity of the state itself. For an individual who was a tourist, ostensibly wandering around in what is one of the world's kind of most important, if you like, religious and cultural sites, to be able to get to do something like this without the security being on him is very, very suspicious, to say the least. And I think that most people are pretty certain that the authorities actually actively encouraged it. And you can see from the actions on that day, because not only was he allowed to carry out the act, the Palestinians who came to start putting out the fire. There was a huge hue and cry. The authorities didn't send their fire brigades in or anything like that. It was the people who came with buckets of water and ordinary items and to tackle the fire. And what happens? The actual military occupation tries to prevent them. In fact, there were fierce clashes, and the people had to break through the lines of the military to get to Al